Andy O'Hagan has said, for good or ill, it was really poetry that made me a writer. And what a writer he is. He seems he can do anything. Fiction, memoir, social history, forensic journalism, very forensic, sometimes brilliantly blurring their boundaries. And he's one of the most serious chroniclers of contemporary Britain and will be needed badly in the next few years. In 2008, he edited a new selection of Robert Burns's poems, and a copy was lodged in every secondary school in Scotland. He says, if great poetry helps you live your life, then what is it exactly that a person can gain from the memorable speech of ghosts? He sees poets as risk takers and miracle workers. His books have been published in 15 languages, and he's won and been shortlisted for countless prizes: the Booker Prize, the Whitbread, the John Llewellyn Rees Prize, the Winifred Holtby Memorial Prize, the James Tate Black Memorial Prize, and the Glenfiddich Spirit of Scotland Award for writing. And his latest book, as Jill has said, is The Secret Life, Three True Stories. He's editor at large for the London Review of Books, where he famously wrote about this tour of the British Isles he did with Seamus Heaney and Carl Miller, and which he's going to talk about today. This is what he says about the tours. I suppose it could be said that we each had an interest in the grounds of literature and in the ground itself. Since I first got to know these men, the landscape of these islands has been transformed. A few years ago, I reported from the farms then witnessing a holocaust in their midst. Farmers in the Lake District were killing their sheep and burying them in Wordsworth's hallowed sod for want of the fuel money to take them to market. And the foot and mouth epidemic was wiping out herds bred over centuries in Wales. Small farmers whelped on common market subsidies, and Don Constable idylls were being priced out of existence by agribusiness and Tesco. In time, the three of us, Carl, Seamus and me, decided to go out there partly to see what we could see, but also as a way of spending time in company with people who shared our quieter interests. We all live in cities, yet on our trips, we dived into rurality and we found new beginnings, fresh shoots, as well as a veritable cairn of endings. To my mind, our journeys were filled with endings, along with the perhaps concluding notion that nature may be larger than memory. The hills of the Scottish borders seemed to say so, as did the trees around Abergavenny and the stones of the Aran Islands. So can I introduce Andy O'Hagan?
Thank you so much. It's such a joy to be here, and what a beautiful evening to see the light coming through those windows like this. It's worth the trip alone. Only once during my school days did I meet a poet. He was Norman McCaig, a Scottish poet taken up with the land and the self, and he was a superstar to me. Possessing a strong Scots accent of the mind. He looked like Scotland too. He was handsome, outlying, dramatic, a mountain of a man with shadows on his face. His eye was intelligent and it watered with a kind of permanent empathy. If he was patriotic, it wasn't obvious. My only country is 6 feet high, he wrote, and whether I love it or not, I'll die for its independence. But his way of speaking constituted a living argument for seeing things from both sides. Years later, I was able to describe the encounter to Seamus Heaney, and with it, I recounted a poem of McCaig's called Lagan Doan Harris, a poem that takes its energy from the spot in the Isle of Harris on the Western Isles. Seamus and I were sitting, of all places, in the Groucho Club in London, as far away from Harris and as far away from what you might call Seamus's natural habitat as human plausibility would allow. Yeah, we had a great night. He too was also a man who liked to occupy both ends of the argument. He said to me once in such a place, "Oh, Andrew, it was excessive, but not enough." As I quoted from Lagendo and Harris, I remember the great poet's fingers massaging the air as if trying to feel for the reality of the words. He massaged the air over that table in the Groucho Club as I read the first words to McCaig's great poem. "Bullock, bellied in a green mud, rolls its brown eyes in a dark delight." And Seamus rolled his eyes in time to the words, as far as I remember. The merit of poetry was its feeling for the common ground, as Ursula quoted me saying. Feeling in both senses, and I remember imagining when I heard McCaig talk that a good novelist might share the poet's healthy ambivalence. Scott Fitzgerald, that most poetic of American novelists, once said that the sign of a first-rate writer was his or her ability to occupy both ends of the argument simultaneously and still function. Poets have that. Great ones. Too much certainty in a writer, though too much certainty might play well for a politician, let's say, but for a writer it's bad. And poetry to me was the art of plurality and the war against too much certainty. In a sense, a poet is the very opposite of an editorialist, the very opposite of a newspaper columnist, that kind of columnist who bangs hard at you with their certainty, with their absolute sense of rightness. A poet will always open up to the possibility that of all the wrongs in the world, they might be the most wrong. Poets know how to live with a divided self, and the play of selfhood in a good collection is inspiring to me. "Self under self, a pile of selves I stand," wrote Norman McCaig. "Threaded on time and with metaphysic hand, lift the farm like a lid and see farm within farm, and in the centre, me." I got to know Seamus Heaney quite well, and this talk is about him, what he meant to me, what he meant to poetry, and to a collective idea of the poet. Seamus was a source of grace, a blessing, and you always knew he was on your side. I was lucky to know those qualities and see them captured in a single name, Seamus. What is it about some people that they seem to carry a kind of moral gladness with them? Not that they are always good or always right, but they hold out the possibility of a better selfhood for everybody. After he died, I felt sore in the heart for a long time, because a light had gone out, a reliable comfort. More than that, a genius with a sublime human touch was now beyond reach. I recalled the story of the little boy who watched as Robert Burns' funeral cortege passed through the town of Dumfries. "But, Mammy, who will be our poet now?" 2 decades ago, when I first worked at the London Review of Books, I was a young editor fresh off the bus from Glasgow Buchanan Street. The first thing that Carl Miller, the legendary, even an editor, said to me was, "How old are you?" I said, "I'm afraid I'm 21. "Why are you afraid?" he said. "Well, have you looked in the mirror recently?" I said. "I like him," he said. 21, he said. Well, I suppose you're one of those happy, optimistic young 21-year-olds gadding about the streets of London looking for entertainment, whilst I am about to step into a box in the ground. He was a bit like that. A bit dramatic was Carl Miller, always and everywhere. But one of my tasks, he did give me the job, and one of the tasks was to... Oh, yes, I must tell you something. Just, you know how you'd often hear people say, that I had a horrible interview experience. My interview experience was the actual worst of all, as far as I've ever heard, which was Carl Miller said to me, okay, are you ready for this interview? And I said, yes, all ruby-cheeked and ready to go I was. He said, okay, could you just name three contemporary Irish poets and talk about their relationship with W.B. Yeats? History, thankfully, doesn't record the mountainous waffling that then occurred. The walls of Bloomsbury have absorbed those particular hellish lines of mine. It makes him evil, actually. I told him later, I said, that was actually the most evil interview question anybody had ever been asked. And he looked with his Edinburgh grinning face and said, I know. So one of my early jobs on the paper was to get people on the phone. Late one afternoon when the paper was going to bed, as we called it, it was press day. There was a lot of frantic stuff going on, as there always is in a press day in an old literary house. Proofs are being banded about, people are screaming, other people are having nervous breakdowns, authors are being sought on the phone to get corrections that they haven't delivered. I looked over in one of these days and saw Carl Miller with the page about 2 millimetres away from his face, as tended to be his wont. Carl was one of those people who behaved as if he was 114. He was actually only about 61 at the time. Anyway, what he was reading, 2 millimetres from the face, was a galley of Seamus's poem in tribute to Hugh McDermott. Seamus was teaching at Harvard University at the time and eventually got him on the phone and passed the call over to Carl Miller. Seamus, he said to his old friend, I'm very grateful to you. The problem, though, is we're delighted with the poem, but there's a mistake in it. A mistake, I imagine Seamus saying. We can't have mistakes in the London Review of Books. The thing is, Seamus, you see, anyway, Seamus, are you still famous? He loved saying that to him. Are you still famous over there in America? I suppose they're driving you up and down Harvard Yard in a gold chariot, that kind of thing. But there is still a mistake in your poem. The thing is, you've got this thing in the poem, Seamus, about McDermott's chattering genius. That's wrong. That's just wrong. I'm from Scotland myself, Seamus. You once said sheep chatter, and I can tell you Scottish sheep don't chatter. They don't, Seamus. They blether. So surely you mean McDermott's blethering genius. Seamus was gracious, as I said. He accepted the amendment with a chuckle and retained it in the volume where the poem is now collected, I'm happy to say. Both men are now dead, but in their later years, the three of us started going on jaunts together. Everywhere we went, Seamus was recognised, and people felt he might have made their day or changed their life. It was part of his good nature that each claim seemed to have the same weight with him. In 2011, I went with him to the University of Strathclyde so that we could receive each, very happily, an honorary doctorate. His wife, Mary, and I thought he wasn't looking well in the car, and indeed, he suffered a minor stroke before the event and was taken to the Royal Infirmary. Before the ambulance doors closed, Seamus gave me his speech and told me to read it out. They'll be waiting, he said. I know you'll do some credit to the words. When the ceremony was over and I turned up at the hospital, he was sitting up in bed joking with Mary, Well, the young, handsome doctor spoke to him about how much he loved his poem, The Skunk, which he'd done at school. I couldn't believe the expression in Seamus's face as this young daughter, who couldn't have been more than 28, regaled him with remembered lines from The Skunk. And it was at that point I realised that Seamus truly was a world poet, and that people would remember those lines and their interactions with him all their lives and beyond their lives. My father had died at the beginning of that week. "No matter what happens," my father had said to me, "make sure you go and do that thing with Seamus. He's been good to you, and he's a lovely man." When I got back to Inverness for my father's funeral, I read a poem of Seamus's there and dropped the poem into his grave. Digging. "Between my finger and my thumb, the squat pen rests, snug as a gun. Under my window, a clean rasping sound when the spade sinks into gravelly ground. My father, digging. I look down till his straining rump among the flower beds bends low, comes up 20 years away, stooping in rhythm through potato drills where he was digging. The coarse boot nestled on the lug, the shaft against the inside knee was levered firmly. He rooted out tall tops, buried the bright edge deep to scatter new potatoes that we picked, loving their cool hardness in the hands. By God, the old man could handle a spade, just like his old man. My grandfather cut more turf in a day than any other man on Toner's Bog. Once I carried him milk in a bottle corked sloppily with paper. He straightened up to drink it, then fell to right away, nicking and slicing neatly, heaving sods over his shoulder, going down and down for the good turf. Digging. The cold smell of potato mould, the squelch and slap of soggy peat, the cut cuts of an edge through living roots awaken in my head. But I've no spade to follow men like them. Between my finger and my thumb, the squat pen rests. I'll dig with it." My father's ancestors had come to Scotland from Marafelt, a few miles from where Seamus grew up, and it felt proper to let the poetry of the old country go down with my father into the stony ground. I knew both men would appreciate it, allowing neighbouring voices to bridge the day, and it gave me comfort to know that all appointments had been met. Memory was everything to Seamus Heaney. The memory of his father digging in the yard, the memory of peeling potatoes with his mother, those same potatoes, or once noticing the glad eye of the coalman. This is what made him kin to my own kin and everybody's kinsmen. Seamus would sometimes express anxiety about giving enough back to the country that bred him, although the fact that you should argue with your own country as you argue with yourself was a given with him, but you still wanted to give your country its due. His attitude in that way, to my mind, was Greek, classical Greek, testing and investigating, in a moral sense, the meaning of loyalty, as opposed to just parroting its hymns. County Tyrone was part of my own family's personal mythology, an unknown place, really, to those who had settled in industrial Glasgow. But it was Seamus's poems that brought the heft and danger of the place back to our lives at the level of strong feeling. From his poem, Two Lorries. It's raining on black coal and warm, wet ashes. There are tyre marks in the yard. Agnew's old lorry has all its cribs down, and Agnew the coalman with his Belfast accent sweet-talking my mother. Would she ever go to a film in Marafelt? But it's raining, and he still has half the load to deliver further on. This time, the load our coal came from was silk black, so the ashes will be the silkiest white. The Marafelt via Tunbridge bus goes by. The half-stripped lorry with its emptied, folded coal bags moves my mother. The tasty ways of a leather-aproned coalman. And films no less. The conceit of a coalman. She goes back in and gets out the black lead and emery paper. This 1940s mother, all business round her stove, half wiping ashes with a backhand from her cheek as the bolted lorry gets revved and turned and heads for Marafelt. And the last delivery, oh, Marafelt. Oh, dream of red plush and city coalman, as time fast forwards and a different lorry groans into shot up Broad Street with a payload that will blow the bus station to dust and ashes. After that happened, I had a vision of my mother, a revenant on the beach where I would meet her in that cold floored waiting room in Marafelt, her shopping bags full up with shoveled ashes. Death walked out past her like a dust-faced coalman, refolding body bags, plying his load empty upon empty in a flurry of motes and engine revs. But which lorry was it now? Young Agnew's? Or that other, heavier, deadlier one, set to explode in a time beyond her time in Marafelt? So tally bags and sweet talk darkness, coalman, listen to the rain spit in new ashes as you heft a load of dust that was for Marafelt, then reappear from your lorry as my mother's dreamboat coalman filmed in silk white ashes. Seamus had a mind to Ireland's memory, the seasonal return of faith and possibility, the falling away and the coming back of things. He cared for this the way other people care about politics. He wanted to offer value to a notion of existence beyond the bounds of sense. And that is where his language led him, to the power of wonder and miracles in daily life. Great is the friend whose one small shove can put you on the upswing. Being with him, I always felt able to give everything its due. The minutes of the day felt slower and more balanced when you were with Seamus. His was a steadiness that befriended the person you wanted to be. In Ayrshire, I once walked with him in a garden next to the town where I grew up. We took our drinks over the grass and I showed him a gap in the trees revealing Ailsa Craig, the rock that stands in the sea between Ireland and Scotland, surrounded, as it always is, by the squall of bad weather and gannets. I saw the rock every morning of my childhood. We called it Paddy's Milestone. The great argument in our childhood was whether the Scottish giant or the Irish giant threw the stone that landed in the sea, creating Paddy's Milestone. Looking over at it with Seamus, we wondered why it hadn't appeared in more poetry. For example, it never appears in the poetry of Robert Burns, who ploughed on that very coast all his life, well, his short life, dying at the age of 40-odds. But it never appears there. But it does appear in a little sonnet written by Keats, and we recounted it between ourselves as we walked through the trees. It was written by Keats on a walking tour of Scotland in 1818. Hearken, thou craggy ocean pyramid, give answer by thy voice. The sea fowl screams. When were thy shoulders mantled in huge streams? When from the sun was thy broad forehead hid? How long it's since the mighty power bid thee heave to airy sleep from fathoms deep. Quite heavy for Keats, that. But actually, it's It's actually quite descriptive of what Paddy's milestone is like in a squally day. Later on that day with Seamus, at the birthplace of Robert Burns, we travelled with Carl, because Carl was with us. Carl said, "I need to go on a trip with you two men because I'm frightened you're having a better time than I am on planet Earth." The possibility that we were having a better time on planet Earth than Carl Miller was a constant preoccupation of his. Both men weren't particularly well by this point. Carl had a pacemaker, and he kept saying, "It's okay for you two young ones, gasping for whiskey as you are, but I've got a small cigarette lighter in my heart, which I want you to pay attention to." So we tried to pay attention to him, but we took him to Robert Burns' birthplace this day. Near Alloway Cottage, there is a multimedia exhibition called the Tam O'Shanter Experience. Carl's face was like fizz. "Soon, I suppose, there'll be the Seamus Heaney experience," he said. "That's right," said Seamus, with a certain savoir-faire. "There'll be a few chuns in a confessional box." I asked Seamus how the folk around where he grew up reacted to him being awarded the Nobel Prize for Literature. "Ignored it for the most part," he said. "But yes, after the Stockholm intervention," that's what he liked to call receiving the Nobel Prize, "after the Stockholm intervention, a certain Jackie Graham of the local grocery shop in Ballachy wanted to open a Heaney museum. It'll be good for you," he said, "and good for us." Seamus didn't stand in his way and made sure some manuscripts and posters were put into the fellow's hands, although history doesn't record if he also organised a confessional box and a couple of old butter churns to go in there. That day we drove on and went to the old church at Ettrick, and Seamus climbed up to the pulpit. It was raining heavily by now, it being Scotland. He began quoting Thomas Hardy's The Darkling Thrush, 31st December 1900. He spoke of a visit he and his wife made to Stinsford Churchyard in Dorset, where Hardy's heart is buried, at Hogmanay in the year 2000. "So quiet in here," I said. And the poet's voice rose up and seemed to rescue the beams from their own dampness. Hardy. "I leant upon a coppice gate when frost was spectre grey, and winter's dregs made desolate the weakening eye of day. The tangled bine stems scored the sky like strings of broken lyres, and all mankind that haunted nigh had sought their household fires. The land's sharp features seemed to be the century's corpse outlent. His crypt, the cloudy canopy, the wind his death lament. The ancient pulse of germ and birth was shrunken hard and dry, and every spirit upon earth seemed fervorless as I. At once a voice arose among the bleak twigs overhead in a full-hearted evensong of joy illimited. An aged thrush, frail, gaunt, and small, in blast-beruffled plume, had chosen thus to fling his soul upon the growing gloom. So little cause for carolings of such ecstatic sound was written on terrestrial things afar on nigh ground, that I could think there trembled through his happy goodnight air some blessed hope whereof he knew and I was unaware." "That's a warm voice, Seamus," I said. "Well," he replied, "the long day wanes, as the master said." Outside the church, there was a blackbird poised on a gravestone, its orange beak seeming cheeky and insistent. The song of the blackbird seemed, well, auspicious, relevant, and most appropriate. Seamus had often written of blackbirds, and in my mind he was a sort of blackbird of poetry, a singing voice, auspicious, relevant, and most appropriate. The greatest of our trips was the one to the west of Ireland. We stopped for lunch at a place that was a favourite of Seamus's called Morin's. It specialises in oysters, and they gave us a table to ourselves in the snug. There was a nice bottle of Alsace, and we all three had chowder. Seamus once wrote a poem after coming here called Oysters. We had driven to that coast through flowers and limestone, and there we were, toasting friendship, laying down a perfect memory in the cool of thatch and crockery. Laying down a perfect memory. That was it, wasn't it? That was the thing. And I knew it at the time. In the main room of Yeats's tower at Ballylee, with the shallow stream below and the light coming at the green-framed window, I looked at Seamus and Carl and suddenly had a vision of a time when none of us would be alive. Yeats wrote about such a feeling in his poem In Memory of Major Robert Gregory. Now that we are almost settled in our house, I'll name the friends that cannot sup with us, or mere companions of my youth, all in my thoughts tonight being dead. There was a point where I wanted to take some pictures of Seamus coming up the winding stair at Tor Ballylee, the tower there where Yeats had retreated. He had a great eye for a cliche, did Seamus, of course. And as soon as he saw me snapping from the upper balcony, the great Nobel Prize winner, the second poetic Nobel Prize winner of that particular century, he said, "Oh, too much, too much. This will be going everywhere the day I die." I never did send it out to the Guardian, in case you're interested. It's still there among the snaps. When we got to the Aran Islands, we left the boat at Inishere. I could hear people whispering Seamus's name. That's how famous he was. And he was very good with it, saying hello to people. The island was so serene and filled with literary echoes. We climbed onto a pony and trap at the pier and were soon off round the island. The man driving the vehicle was the very picture of robust outdoor health. And Seamus took pleasure, he said, in the way the fellow, quote, lazily whipped the pony every few seconds. It's very Seamus, that use of the word lazily. Lazily whipped the pony. And indeed, I can still see the very gossamer end of the whip touching the pelt of the horse, of the donkey. So we were watching this man do that for quite some time, and the rhythm of this was quite entrancing. And eventually the ruddy-faced man turned to Seamus. "You're the famous poet," he said. He clearly thought Seamus was a countryman who had made it into the universe of electricity and television. "Well, it's been said of me, it's been said probably too many times," Seamus said. The next day, back in Dublin, Seamus took us over to St. Patrick's Cathedral, and we stopped before Swift's grave, reading Yeats's tribute, then Pope's. I went round the corner from there and saw a plaque on the wall to Swift's servant, put there apparently by Swift himself. I thought this was very cheerfully democratic, and I said so to Seamus as we stood in the cathedral's main aisle. "Diligence and prudence," said Seamus. "Well played, that man." 3 winters passed before we got another journey together. We'd been thinking about Wales for some time and set out at the start of that summer of 2010. Seamus agreed that we should pick him up at a hotel near Birmingham Airport. By the Birkenhill Parkway, Seamus was standing outside his hotel next to a fire engine as the entire human contents of the building were evacuated in a drill. Seamus was staring into space. "Look," said Carl Miller. "The great bucolic contemplates life among the ring roads." The landscape of the Welsh border was green and silvery and not short of magnificence, of course, as you know, especially. The hills rising from nowhere. Wordsworth saw a model of immortality in the hills. Without the consciousness of a principle of immortality in the human soul, writes Wordsworth in his essay upon epitaphs, man could never have awakened in him the desire to live in the remembrance of his fellows. To live in the remembrance of them. To be born and to die are the two points in which all men feel themselves to be an absolute coincidence. The grave of the poet Henry Vaughan can be found on a hill next to the River Usk. He lies in the graveyard of Langsanford Church, where there are trees on every side, the trees advancing like Burnham Wood. There are words, of course, on all the graves, but more than that, there are words in the air, the words of Vaughan's greatest poem. They are all gone into the world of light, and I alone sit lingering here. Their very memory is fair and bright, and my sad thoughts doth clear. It glows and glitters in my cloudy breast, like stars upon some gloomy grove, or those faint beams in which this hill is dressed after the sun's remove. Either disperse these mists, which blot and fill my perspective still as they pass, or else remove me hence unto that hill, where I shall need no glass. Vaughan's grave is under a giant yew tree. It is stained with moss and lichens, its Latin phrases shaded. There's no obvious path up the road, so we climbed through the grass and found the grave looking not obscure, but unvisited. There's a bench to one side with a bank of very old gravestones, some as old as Vaughan's, 1695, now attached to the wall for their preservation. I took pictures while Carl and Seamus sat on a bench and argued about the Latin on Vaughan's grave. It was always interesting to see the two fellows discuss, usually, Latin problems. Carl, again, in his best Edinburgh mode, would grit his teeth and remind Seamus that he'd made several mistakes in the last 20 seconds. He liked to think that a boy educated at the Edinburgh High School had seniority when it came to the parsing of Latin phrases. Seamus was almost 100% correct in every case. Seamus later wrote a poem about that visit where he referred to me as Ardent Andrew and pictured him and Carl on the mossy seat. "Well, here's Vaughan," said Carl. "A believer. Certainly a believer. I mean, it's hard to think of you, Seamus, now, without belief. I find it hard not to believe you believe." "I stopped practicing a long time ago," said Seamus. "But some of it holds. If you have it as a child, it gives you a structure of consciousness. A structure of consciousness. The idea there is something more." "I probably wouldn't go that far," said Carl. "But I have to say, I always believed I'd see my granny again. She was good to me." "For me, it was my father," said Seamus. "I'd hope to see him again, all right." We stayed there for a while, and Seamus spoke about T.S. Eliot and his four quartets. In all our gadding about, there had been many versions of pastoral and an easy dalliance of time past and time present. But I sensed that, for Seamus at least, it wasn't like Eliot's Rose Garden up there in Wales. It was just a place where you could rest your bones, take a breath. And that's what we did that day, as the world of light came into the trees. I remember as we drove away towards Abergavenny, that Seamus said, you know that T.S. Eliot and Vernon Scammell had something in common. They both worked for banks. I said, is that right, Seamus? He said, yeah, but, you know, but I think you'd have to admit that where Scammell was a branch man, Eliot was very much head office. I remember sitting in a pub in Sligo with the greatest poetry critic in the world. I won't name her outright because she has a horror of being named. But during the evening, she unfurled a series of stories about great poets she had known and the trouble they had living with themselves or their talent or both. With gentle understanding, she caught what poets take on, the sense that many people share without knowing it, that great poets experience some of our loneliness for us. We spoke of Robert Lowell and Dylan Thomas and Wallace Stevens's family household in Connecticut. We spoke of other things, but we kept coming back to poetry and the menace of forgetting that you couldn't live without. It was good to hear Yeats at 1 a.m. in the corner of an old pub in Sligo. Yet they were of a different kind, the names that stilled your childish play. They have gone about the world like wind, but little time had they to pray for whom the hangman's rope was spun. And what, God help us, could they save? Romantic Ireland's dead and gone. It's with O'Leary in the grave. The main character in Tennessee Williams's early play Battle of Angels sells shoes and writes poems on the shoeboxes. I never did that, but understood the basic instinct, and I had a Saturday job in a shoe shop in Irvine on the west coast of Scotland, not far from that Paddy's Milestone that I mentioned to you. I'd go to a bookshop in Ayr after work sometimes and buy the poems of Edwin Muir or Kenneth Rexroth, Dylan Thomas, as if owning a volume or two might steel your nerve and sharpen your pencil. 3 decades on, driving through the same landscape with Seamus, I found there was more laughter in the poetry game than I'd ever imagined. After trips to Scotland, Ireland and Wales, we made a final trip to the Isle of Iona, the place where Colum Chiel had landed with his party of Irish monks in the 8th century. I knew it would appeal to Seamus. The field of dead Scottish kings and the sound of the sea in the side chapel of the abbey, and I took pictures as we walked down to the sea. I reminded Seamus of a moment in Adam Nan's Life of St. Columba, where the great man summons the very snakes out of the sea and believes in fiction and the power of the human imagination to transform the world and ourselves. It was a crossing point for us, that island, the royal bogmen and the birth of Christianity in Scotland. 2 of the friends in that trip, as I say, are now dead. But I still see Seamus that morning by the bay, looking over to the Isle of Staffa and talking up the legend of Fingal's Cave. As we looked out, I could almost hear the squall, the beautiful squall of Mendelssohn's Scottish Symphony, which was inspired by a journey to that same Staffa. I could also see a blackbird suddenly that hopped onto the wall. Seamus saw its yellow beak and a sunbeam hit the grass. Miraculous, he said. It was the last day of our trip, and the ferry soon appeared in Iona Sound. Later, as the boat sailed out, I looked back and imagined my friends again in the cloisters, where the monks had once come from Ireland to give the locals an education in belief. I somehow knew by then that the final trip to see Tennyson's grave in the Isle of Wight would be one I would make alone. But crossing the Sound, I imagined those monks in the 7th century adding colour to the illuminated book they had started at Kells, and I thought of Seamus's poem, The Blackbird, Blackbird of Glanmore, the last word, a mythic quality over the sound, reaching into our lives as the days poured into the future. We'd agreed on that final trip to the Isle of Wight to bring England back into the fold, but I feared for it. But I knew I would take the belief in creativity and in poetry there for all three of us. Seamus and Carl didn't make it. And I set out regularly now to make that journey by myself. I always think of them. I always want to find the place where In Memoriam began, Tennyson's great poem to lost friendship. I want to light a candle there, remembering the poet's words, Seamus's words, now another bright glow in the common memory and of our shared decency. On the grass, when I arrive, filling the stillness with life, he wrote, but ready to scare off at the very first wrong move in the ivy, when I leave, it's you, Blackbird, I love. Thank you. We have got time for questions, and it's great that we're in such a nice, cosy place because we don't need the famous roving mic. Just stick your hand up. I'm happy to answer anything that you might have, either in relation to Seamus' poetry or my own work. Yes, sir. Come at me.
You said Seamus said, comparing Chet Elliott as a bank manager, he said the same thing to me, actually.
Oh, yes.
It was Vernon Watkins, not Vernon Scannell.
Oh, yes, sorry, yes. You got it right. Thank you. Thank you. You can have a job at the London Review of Books anytime you like. Yes, anybody else?
Could I ask, did you find the chance to make these journeys at the end of June, beginning of July?
They were at different times, but yes, some were.
The reason I ask that is we always ask Seamus if he could come to this festival.
We crept round the back.
You, John, you came in, but good on you for doing so. We'll forgive you for that.
See, now I would question your political instincts had you come to us first. We would have plied him with whiskey on the road, you see. We would have steered him into this hall before, or perhaps a significantly bigger hall, and you would have had him, but no, it never came up. Anybody else? Anything at all? We've got 5 minutes or so.
Yes, I've got a question.
Yes.
When's your first book of poetry coming out?
Never.
But if poetry inspired you to write, this isn't fair for us.
Well, you know, it's the price I pay for having admired it too much. I mean, I think, to misquote Kenneth Tynan, I think it's the most difficult thing you can do with a pen. And speaking as somebody who is a novelist for a living and who writes, as you said, Ursula, long non-fiction pieces, neither of which are easy, I have to tell you, there's something about the absolute finessefulness of poetry, which I want, in some sense, want to remain an admirer of rather than a casualty of. And I think sometimes as a writer, you want to know your limits. For the time being, anyway, that's very much at the outer limits for me. I sometimes write poems for my daughter. I have a 13-year-old daughter who can't wait to get rid of me and my poetry-making self in order to get on Facebook. But nevertheless, I pursue her across the kitchen with little lyrics I've written about her, and they always annoy her. But I've written them for her birthday and her Christmas and various things, and she's, you know, in the natural way of things, 13-year-olds are mortified by their fathers. I just add fuel to the fire by writing these little things. But for the time being, as a part of my publishing life, I just can't see it. Yes.
I'm just curious to know if Seamus wrote a poem for you.
The poem that I quoted from with Arden Andrew in it was actually a birthday poem that he wrote for Carl Miller. And we had to read it at a dinner, a celebration of Carl. But a whole poem for me, never. Just got a mention. Can you believe that after all my efforts? Can you imagine how much driving I did? I don't remember how long I spent on the phone to bed and breakfast places in the Isle of Iona. Seamus. No, I never a whole poem, but I don't hold it against him, obviously. Yes, madam.
I'd like you to remind us of the very last words of Seamus Heaney, because I've always viewed him as being a poet who could speak of love.
Yeah.
In a very, very deep way. And I thought his very last words to his wife absolutely were so beautiful.
They were in Latin. I don't have them to mind, but do you, sir? Does anybody here have them? That's right. Yeah. Yeah. That was very like him. Well remembered. You. See? Cambridge always wins out in the end, I find. yes, there's somebody else over here. Yes, I did get there, but I've never written about the trips. But I did write a novel called Be Near Me, which was very much drawn from In Memoriam. The lines, be near me when my light is low, etc., are from In Memoriam. And I took the title of the book, actually, from the poem. And the main character in that novel was a Tennysonian, a great Tennyson obsessive. And so I feel that Tennyson's been in my life for quite a long time. But in this regard, in relation to going there without Seamus and Carl, I've made the trip several times, but I've never been able to write about it. I think it's something I'd like to keep perhaps for later when I'm older myself than I am now, simply because I think it will grow. Certain things grow for you as a writer with the years. Not everything should be laying down like wine in the hope that it, you know, improves, but there are things that I think can improve, certainly with age, some writing that can, and I feel that if I make it to the age those men were, then something of that trip and what it meant to me as a younger man will come through. I'd like to write about it in a memoir someday, and write a memoir about Seamus and Carl and my time as a young writer, I suppose.
I hope you will do it and lift the Isle of Wight onto the same wonderful plane of Wales, Scotland and Ireland. I live opposite the Isle of Wight and my heart never sings. With you, my heart has been singing through your whole talk.
Thank you so much. That's so kind of you. No, I did always feel that the boys were trying to do something Celtic and underhand by not including England in the trip. Don't think I didn't notice that. So as a rabble-rouser and a troublemaker and someone who regularly commits the sin of London, that was an invention of Carl Miller's. He said, oh, you're becoming well-known for having committed the sin of London. Everybody in Scotland must hate you by now, he said. But having given that he not only committed the sin of London, but he invented the London Review of Books, I was able to come back at him with some energy. But I think the lads were a bit slow, shall I say, about including England in the quartet. And it was me that was insisting that we go to the Isle of Wight. But sadly, time ran out. We did actually go to Dove Cottage, or we made a plan to go to Dove Cottage. It was going to be the lakes. But unfortunately, Seamus was unwell. Pretty badly unwell at the point where we were going to go there, so he couldn't, so we had to cancel that trip. So we kept being dashed in our attempts to extend the poetic love to England, but don't worry, I'll get my own back. Yes, ma'am.
What persuaded Seamus to come with you?
Love of... love of Carl Miller. Carl Miller was the first, I should say, to my friends and colleagues in here. Carl published Seamus' first poems in The Listener. He was sent a group of poems by Seamus before Death of a Naturalist, before Seamus' first volume of poems came out. He sent a bunch of poems to Carl Miller, who was the literary editor of the, I think it was the New Statesman then, actually. because he'd been on the Spectator, the New Statesman, then the Listener, and then founded the London Review of Books. So I think he sent these poems, this would be late 50s, early 60s, and Carl loved these poems, including Digging, and put them all into that Christmas issue of the New Statesman, and it launched Seamus's career. And he was then offered a contract by Seamus, by Favour and Favour, sorry, and the rest is history. But so he always loved, he had a gracious man's love of the progenitor, you know, never forgot the people who made him, put him in the position. Of course, he was a great writer. He would have found his position, you could argue. But nonetheless, he appreciated the people. He never left them behind, the literary editors, the friends, the readers, the other poets and writers who he had served his apprenticeship with. And I think there's a lesson in that for younger writers. You know, you meet them again, usually on the way back down. but Seamus knew that, and he was wonderful to Carl. So he wanted to come on those trips because he knew Carl was unwell. And even although he was actually unwell himself died before Carl, he came and put all his energy. When I think back now, I had them running, tearing up and down hills and dales the whole time. And I now sort of slightly sort of blink when I think how much of... But they wanted to, and there was always a pub afterwards. And I'll take one more question. I know that you're keen to...
Have you been to Balabi, to the visitor centre, and you've been...
No, funnily enough, I was asked last year and this year, but the timing was wrong and I couldn't make it. I was supposed to speak there. And in fact, when they heard that I was doing so here, I got a cuff round the ear by email, if you can get a cuff by email. And nonetheless, I'm delighted to be here, but I'll go there hopefully next time and I'll get to see the famous butter churns in the confessional box. I might have to step into the confessional box myself for half an hour, but there's none. Oh, very good. Well, you've got the pen, you've got everything. But anyway, ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for being great company tonight.